Today is Tuesday, January 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump rejects a compromise to end the partial U.S. government shutdown.
What is he supposed to do? Just give in? He's not going to give in.
An emphatic denial from the president over accusations of working with the Russians.
It's a whole big fat hoax. It's just a hoax.
Calls are growing for a recount in Congo's recent elections. Also ahead, a tribute to the late, great Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump on Monday denied he ever worked for Russia against U.S. interests as he addressed the extraordinary question that has haunted his presidency from the beginning and shows no sign of going away. Speaking from the South Lawn, Trump issued a flat denial.
I never worked for Russia. Not only did I never work for Russia, I think it's a disgrace that you even asked that question, because it's a whole big fat hoax. It's just a hoax.
Trump raised eyebrows over the weekend when he didn't directly answer the Russia question in an interview with Fox News host Jeanine Pirro, a friend of his. He was asked about a New York Times report that law enforcement officials began investigating in 2017 whether Trump had been working on behalf of Russia against U.S. interests. Trump said the question was insulting, but at that time didn't directly deny it. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reported over the weekend that Trump has made a concerted effort to keep hidden the details of his private meetings with Russian President Vladimir Putin over the past 2 years. I recently spoke with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Greg Miller, who authored that Washington Post report over the weekend. He has a new book. It's called The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy, which pieces together the stories they have published on this saga over the past few years.
This really is built on the reporting that we were doing at the Washington Post in 2016 and 2017. It won the Pulitzer Prize this year. And, you know, we broke a lot of stories. We broke stories about Mike Flynn. We were the first to report that the DNC had been hacked. We were the first to report that the CIA had reached a conclusion that Russia was trying to help elect Donald Trump. And so publishers were coming to the Post during that time and asking, you know, interested in a book by the Post writers responsible for these stories. And that's really how this came together. I think that the benefit for readers, and frankly for myself even, it was to be able to sit down and do this in a book in a way that puts together this story in a comprehensible way. Because when we were writing these breaking stories week to week, day to day, sometimes it was so easy to get lost and to fail to see connections that really jump out at you when you really lay them out on a single timeline.
Certainly the news cycle in the past year and a half since President Trump was elected has been a whirlwind of changing events constantly, and there's so many layers to it, and it sounds like it would be logical to put it all together that way.
And there's a ton of new reporting here. You know, it starts with those sort of some of those initial stories, but I've gone back through and re-interviewed people we knew at the time and were talking to at the time to get really behind-the-scenes detail on things that were happening inside the DNC and during the hack and at the CIA when they sort of start to catch wind of this, then inside the Obama White House. This book, it's not just a retrospective on the election. It's current. It takes us right up to the current moment in the Trump-Russia investigation by Robert Mueller. So there are details inside of this unraveling of Trump's legal team earlier this year, his unresolved showdown with Mueller over whether Trump is ever going to sit down for an interview with him. So it's just tying all of that together in a book that I think reads more like a novel or a screenplay.
We don't know the conclusion yet. How were you able to piece it together without that? Special Counsel Mueller's investigation has not concluded.
Yeah, so I sort of look at this as a three-act play, and we've been through Act Two. And Mueller, we're not sure when, but I think it will not be very long from now that, you know, we will see the opening of Act Three, which will be the completion of his investigation and what that sets in motion in Congress. potentially impeachment hearings for President Trump, depending on what Mueller finds. But even though we don't know the outcome of the investigation, I feel like we already know a great deal about what Mueller is investigating, and the story itself is really built around the events of 2016 and 2017. And we also know different kinds of conclusions. I don't think it's too early to look back on this period already and think that it's pretty clear that Vladimir Putin and Russia won, that their interference achieved a greater impact and created and caused more damage and dysfunction and confusion in the United States, largely compounded because of how Trump has conducted himself as president, than we ever thought possible. So the book really is also an attempt to come to terms with that, sort of reckon with what this tells us about ourselves and in America as an increasingly frayed and fractured society.
Does the book also come to any conclusions regarding the president's role in working with the Russians?
Yeah, there are many, many areas of the book that deal with his financial connections with Russia, his attempts to do business deals there in terms of real estate developments and things like that. There's sort of painstakingly reconstructed his attempts to meet Putin over the years, and the behind-the-scenes accounts from inside the Trump Tower meeting that Trump's son and close advisors had with Russian operatives saying that they were coming with damaging information on Hillary Clinton. We don't know, maybe Robert Mueller does, whether there is some kind of smoking gun memorandum out there in which Putin and Trump both agree in advance that they're going to try to work together to win the White House. I'm skeptical that we're ever going to see anything like that, but I think the amount of information that we have right now tells us that there was extensive, at least pulling in the same direction, if not explicit collusion or conspiracy between Trump campaign and the Trump presidency and Russia.
The president, we know he had for a long time before he became president, he had a show called The Apprentice, the reality TV show where people compete to work for him. What made you, besides the obvious reason that we know when we think of The Apprentice, it's Donald Trump, what made you decide to actually call the book The Apprentice?
When I thought of it, it worked on several levels. As you said, it's the name of the reality show that propelled him to such great fame in the United States. But, you know, it's also a term you could use to describe him in the start of his presidency. He was apprentice-like in his lack of preparation for the job. He had never held public office. He had never looked at a classified document, never run a government agency, really unfamiliar with the demands of the position, and had to do a lot of learning on the job. You know, what the book is really focused on and built around is this mystery about his relationship with Vladimir Putin. Why is it that he seems so subservient to Putin at times, can never criticize him, always cultivating closer relationships with Putin, praises him, clings to the sort of Russian talking points, and can't accept the reality that Russia interfered in the U.S. election.
Well, that is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Greg Miller. His new book, he works for The Washington Post. He reporting over the weekend, obviously, on the big story. His new book, The Apprentice. And meanwhile, special counsel Robert Mueller was appointed to take over investigations involving Trump and Russia in May of 2017 after Trump fired FBI Director James Comey. The number of airport security screeners failing to show up for work is soaring as the partial U.S. government shutdown continues. No shows among screeners jumped Sunday and again on Monday. While the Transportation Security Administration reported a national absence rate of 7.6% compared with 3.2% on a comparable day a year ago. At Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport, the world's busiest, it reported long lines on its website Monday, showing hour-plus waits at all three checkpoints in the domestic terminal. Keith Polite is a security officer at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian in New York. He says as a subcontracted federal employee, he will not get any back pay.
It definitely hurts. Makes me feel almost less of a man to pick up the phone and ask for money, because I'm going to have to use up all my savings. So I'm going to need help, because remember, we're contract employees, so we have no money coming in. So even if the strike is over tomorrow, I'm still behind the eight ball.
During his brief comments to reporters Monday, President Trump rejected a short-term legislative fix and dug in for more combat Monday, declaring he would never, ever back down. He also said Republicans are in total agreement.
The Republicans are rock solid. We've got to take care of our border. Many of the people, and they're all going to get their money, many of the people that aren't being paid right now are in total agreement with us.
With the partial shutdown of the federal government now in its fourth week, Trump continues to hold out the possibility that he will declare a national emergency along the southern border with Mexico. Trump could use the declaration to fund his long-sought border wall, but Democrats and even some Republicans oppose the idea as an overreach of executive authority. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
President Trump at the southern border, seeking to deliver on his central campaign promise of a border wall with Mexico. But with Democrats in Congress firmly opposed to the wall, Trump continues to consider declaring a national emergency to fund it.
I have the absolute legal right to call it, but I'm not looking to do that because this is too simple. The Democrats should say we want border security, we have to build a wall, otherwise you can't have border security, and we should get on with our lives.
Some Republicans believe that may be a way out of the government shutdown, including Senator Lindsey Graham.
Seems to me the only way left is for him to exercise that authority. I don't see any action in the Congress.
The House will be in order.
Yet Democrats oppose an emergency declaration, including Maryland Congressman Anthony Brown.
The use of these authorities, like the deployment of our troops to the border, is irresponsible, unnecessary, and misguided. Mr. Speaker, we don't have a crisis on the border. We have a crisis in the Oval Office.
Presidents generally have a lot of leeway to declare a national emergency, says analyst John Hudak.
The president has a fairly broad power to declare a national emergency. According to a pretty firm reading of that law, it's hard to see where there is an exception to the president's ability to do it.
But Hudak notes there are constitutional limits on the president's power.
Presidents have tried to go around Congress in terms of spending money in the past, and frequently presidents are stopped because the spending power in the Constitution rests with the Congress.
And put our people back to work!
Public opinion polls show more Americans blame Trump for the shutdown than opposition Democrats. But the president remains focused on his political base, says Larry Sabato.
This isn't going to end until at least parts of Trump's base agree to go along or say, well, you tried your best. Those darn Democrats just won't give in.
Trump's strategy involves high political risk, says John Hudak.
President Trump is playing to his base here, but unfortunately his base is a small percentage of the population, and most of the rest of the population is not with him on this issue of the wall.
Trump is counting that his commitment to building the wall will shore up his political base for his re-election bid next year. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Russia toughens its stance in the islands dispute with Japan. A Taliban official is telling VOA peace talks with the U.S. have stalled. Poland's liberal mayor of Gdansk dies after stabbing. And the U.S. withdrawal from Syria is concerning minorities. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A Chinese court has sentenced a Canadian man to death on drug trafficking charges. The decision was handed down Monday against Robert Lloyd Schellenberg, who was originally detained in 2014 and given a 15-year prison sentence in November, but was retried as prosecutors argued his sentence was too lenient. Schellenberg has denied the charges against him, and his lawyer says he will likely appeal. The decision will likely aggravate already strained relations between Canada and China over what appears to be retaliatory steps taken by China after Canadian authorities arrested a Chinese tech company executive. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Margaret Lewis, a law professor at Seton Hall University's Law School, whose research focuses on law in mainland China. She says it's difficult to clearly determine what has occurred and the reasons why.
The challenge with China is there's so much we don't know. The timing is suspicious, especially given that it was swift in the final decision, but this case languished in the courts for years prior to the detention of Meng Wanzhou in early December. And the shift from slow gear to a rapid decision to have a much more severe sentence is definitely suspicious.
Suspicious. Is there any precedent of something like this happening before?
Precedent is difficult when you lack transparency. The number of executions in China remains a state secret, despite the courts in China publishing vast amounts of data that is curated to leave out particularly death sentences that in a way that would allow us to figure out patterns over time. The fact that this has happened not only so quickly after the December detention in Canada, but also with the Chinese government not just allowing but welcoming foreign attention to these proceedings, makes it so there's not a long inferential bridge to say the two things are likely connected.
Canada is in a position, and I take it from what you've said, they've almost put themselves in this position as between a rock and a hard place between China and the United States. Do you agree?
I think that Canada put itself in the position of enforcing its laws and cooperating with its partners in international law enforcement, that Canada would, after receiving information from the United States, hold someone pending an extradition proceeding is how the law is supposed to operate. I think the country here that's ramped up the pressure and made this into a political decision is China.
Let's talk about Robert Lloyd Schellenberg. He has been in jail for quite some time, and now he has been given the death sentence, and the Chinese say they have information that he was trying to distribute and sell methamphetamine, and transport it to Australia. Is there any validity to that that you can see?
Again, we know what the Chinese government wants us to know, but if indeed it was 222 kilograms or anything close to that amount, I mean, that's greater weight than I think the size of a large male gorilla. That's a lot of drugs. I mean, that's taken very seriously under Chinese law, even if there is no political overtone. That is an offense, smuggling drugs of quantities, even of much lesser amounts, that could be subject to the death penalty. So as far as applying the death penalty to a case involving drug smuggling, that's not shocking. What is questionable here is that we have bits and pieces of information about the government's case. And it sounds like the government's theory of the case shifted from Mr. Schellenberg being a relatively low-level player in this alleged drug smuggling operation to then saying he actually was a core participant, much higher responsibility in this plan. That shift, if indeed true, that someone was more involved in the planning, would be a relevant factor in Chinese law with respect to sentencing, along with the weight of the drugs and other factors.
This is not the first action that has been taken against Canadians who are in China. Two people have been arrested or detained or whatever. Where does this go from here?
Anyone's guess. So if we just had one data point, it would be concerning. We now have several data points of Canadians who, since December 1st, have in a very high-profile manner been held, or in this case, sentenced to the death sentence. The more data points we have and the more statements we have out of whether it be Chinese diplomats abroad or other mouthpieces of the Chinese government, the more that it sounds like this is, you know, an attempt to up the pressure on the Canadian government to bend to the wishes of Beijing. One thing I noted in what information we've received so far in Mr. Schellenberg's case is that he has been sentenced to death with essentially not immediate execution, but fairly rapid execution under the criminal procedure law. Another possibility would have been going from the original 15-year sentence to death with a 2-year reprieve, a suspended death sentence. And the court reports indicate that at least one other person involved in this alleged operation did receive that sentence, which is often commuted to a long prison sentence. So what Mr. Schellenberg received was the most severe sentence available under Chinese law.
All right, that's Margaret Lewis, law professor at Seton Hall University's Law School. Her research focuses on law in mainland China. The presidential election in the Democratic Republic of Congo is over, but the fallout from this contentious poll is building. Several African bodies are calling for a recount, and the candidate who says he was cheated out of a victory has challenged the official results in court. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Pretoria.
This is new territory for the Democratic Republic of Congo. The nation appears poised to see its first ever opposition president take power in a poll that has been widely criticized for irregularities and delays. But first, the man who believes he actually won the poll wants his day in court. On Saturday, opposition coalition leader Martin Fayulu, who was favored by polls to win the December 30th vote, asked the Constitutional Court to order a recount. On Sunday, Fayulu attended church in the capital, Kinshasa, with his family and a bevy of enthusiastic followers. We have faith, and our faith is intact, he says. Undaunted, because the people have decided and the will of the people will be realized. I'm a man of faith. Fayulu's choice of venue was no accident. For many Congolese citizens, the Catholic Church is the sole provider of schooling, healthcare, and basic services. And so, when the church said vote tallies collected by its 40,000 election observers show Fayulu won the election, citizens listened. Then last week, the Electoral Commission announced that opposition leader Felix Tshisekedi had won according to provisional results. That announcement sparked surprise and outrage, and not just from the usual quarters. The Southern African Development Community, SADC, called for a recount of the vote and a government of national unity. Their call was supported late Sunday by another African bloc, the International Conference of the Great Lakes Region. Analyst Stephanie Walters of the Institute for Security Studies says these statements from regional mediators are surprising.
It is a departure from how they've handled other electoral crises in member states. It's also certainly a departure from some of the weaker statements that SADC has made on the DRC. It's really taken a very hands-off approach to this electoral crisis over the last 3 years. So it's a surprise. In terms of how effective it can be, I think we have some doubts.
That's because, she says, the body in charge of declaring a recount, the Constitutional Court, is loyal to longtime President Joseph Kabila. In the election, Kabila backed his former Interior Minister, Emmanuel Shadary. But Shadary finished third in the voting, and analysts say that he was so obviously unpopular that it would have provoked serious outrage had the Electoral Commission anointed him the winner. Although Kabila is stepping down, analysts think he aims to play a dominant role behind the scenes when, or if, Tshisekedi takes office. The Constitutional Court has 10 days from Fayulu's filing to rule. Meanwhile, the Electoral Commission also announced that Kabila's ruling Common Front for Congo, FCC party, led the parliamentary vote. That means the president-elect, who heads the Union for Democracy and Social Progress, UDPS, party, may have some political struggles ahead, says analyst Claude Kabemba, director of Southern Africa Resource Watch.
If there is marriage between the FCC and UDPS, not to last for very long, it's not a marriage by conviction. And that's a problem. And they will have serious tension.
But before any of that can happen, the court needs to decide. Recount the vote or risk legitimacy by letting the results stand. Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa,
around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. In Congo, more than 600 people have contracted the Ebola virus, which has claimed close to 400 lives. The disease has been difficult to contain because of conflict in the region, despite an effective vaccine. But now, VOA's Carol Pearson reports health workers may soon be able to cure those with the disease.
The world cheered when a healthy baby girl was born to a mother who had recovered from Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo. 61% of those who get Ebola in this outbreak are likely to die, despite the best efforts of health workers armed with a vaccine. and with techniques learned from an Ebola outbreak in West Africa that ended in 2016. So far, there's no one treatment that can cure people of the three deadly strains of Ebola, although after years of effort, that may be changing. An international team of scientists has developed a treatment that can cure the Zaire strain that's circulating in Congo and the two other deadly strains of the virus. What's more, the treatment requires just one injection. Thomas Geisbert headed up his part of the research at the University of Texas Medical Branch, where he's a professor of microbiology and immunology.
Until when an outbreak first happens, we don't know which strain caused that outbreak until cases start coming in and you start having people. At that point, you're going to have deaths. You're going to have people already dying, people very ill. And, once you know what that strain is, yes, you can have one bug, one drug, and if you have those countermeasures available. The disadvantage of that is that, again, these drugs are extremely expensive to make.
With a universal treatment, time isn't lost determining which strain of the virus is circulating, and people can be treated immediately. What's more, countries where Ebola is likely to break out can stockpile the drug ahead of an outbreak. The goals now are to see if the dose can be lowered and still be effective, which would lower the price, and to start clinical trials to make sure the treatment is safe and effective in humans. The treatment may not be ready to help those with Ebola in Congo, but the promise is that countries affected by the virus could have the treatment at the ready to stop future outbreaks of this deadly disease. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
The late Aretha Franklin's songs were so impactful that some of music's bests, from Alicia Keys to Celine Dion, took the stage Sunday to relive the Queen of Soul's biggest hits in a taped tribute concert. Every rendition of Franklin's songs, from A Change Is Going to Come to Respect to I Say a Little Prayer, brought audience members to their feet at the Aretha, a Grammy celebration for the Queen of Soul in Los Angeles. A montage of Franklin was shown throughout the show, including one with on-screen quotes paying homage to her from former President Barack Obama, Barbara Streisand, Willie Nelson, and Tony Bennett. Franklin died at the age of 76 from pancreatic cancer last year in her Detroit apartment. Some of her family members, including her grandson who spoke at her funeral, were in attendance at the tribute, which was hosted by filmmaker and actor Tyler Perry. Jennifer Hudson, who will star in Franklin's biopic, Respect, kicked off the tribute that will air March 10th on CBS. The Dreamgirls actress set the tone for an energetic night, performing Think while wearing a stunning white dress. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com, and we certainly thank you for being with us. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a beautiful day.
This is VOA News.